I want to suggest to you that our world is in crisis, that our planet is spinning out of control, that we're heading for a collision with our Creator, that not only do unregenerate men not have the answers to the pressing problems of the 20th century, they're not even asking the right questions. The foundations are coming unzipped. The principles of morality are coming unglued. Our world is in grave danger. Unregenerate men are like a blind man in a dark room looking for a black cat that isn't there. The only solution to the problems of the 20th century is an understanding of the Word of God and the Lord Jesus Christ, who is central to that Word of God. We have only recently concluded our Jubilee, our 50th anniversary celebration here in southern New Jersey. And I am so pleased to be able to tell you that we had friends of this mission from all over the world who came to be with us and to celebrate with us during five very exciting days. In connection with those days, we had planned to have a symposium. We had planned to have seven men share with us their insight into the prophetic word of God and what is happening in Israel during these very crucial days of human history. Unfortunately, that meeting was scheduled to be out of doors under a tent, and we had a very severe electric storm, and we had to cancel the meeting, although more than 1,000 people had shown up to be spectator to that occasion. However, our home church invited us to conduct that symposium the following day in their auditorium, and we did so, and the church was crowded. And what you're going to listen to in just a few moments is a two-tape series on that symposium. So I hope you'll sit back, get comfortable, relax, open your heart, open your mind, and listen to what some of these men have to say concerning pertinent questions for the last decade of the 20th century. Among many other things, I am concerned that the media has not been presenting what is truly going on in the Middle East, and particularly in Israel, from a historical context. They are taking events but divorcing them from the events that have led up to that particular situation, and it is necessary for you to have something of a fuller view. Now, of necessity, we can only touch on these things, but it is my hope that the comments will give some clarification to you so that as believers you can intelligibly interact with what is happening in the Middle East from the standpoint of the present day and also the prophetic implications. So let me, without saying anything further, introduce to you our distinguished panel. And let me begin on your right, and on your right is Mr. Alan Cohen. Mr. Alan Cohen is an Israeli. He is a guide in Israel. He has traveled the length and breadth of the land. He has had family who have served in the military, and he is very, very, very knowledgeable concerning the current events in the land of Israel. And then next to him is Eli Langbaum. Eli served in the Israeli army as a sergeant major, and in case you don't know it, it is the sergeant majors that run the military, and he served for many, many, many years as a sergeant major. He is also an Israeli guide who travels regularly the length and breadth of the land and is exceedingly knowledgeable. And both of these men from Israel have lectured times without number on the events that are going on in Israel. So they bring a unique expertise to our discussion this evening. And then next to him is a young Israeli who has served in the Israeli military. He is also a believer. He is a student of the Word of God, and will be returning to Israel in just a few weeks after a year of intensive study here in America at the Institute of Biblical Studies. Then next to him is Will Varner, who all of you know, a member of this congregation, a biblical scholar, the dean of the Institute of Biblical Studies. He takes teaching tours to Israel on a regular basis, has been there many, many times. This is an area of expertise, and he'll bring an exciting dimension to our consideration. And next to him is a gentleman that many of you know, if not personally, through his life story or through his articles. His name is Zvi, And Zvi is a survivor of the Holocaust, who went to Israel in 1948, has fought in all of Israel's wars, is a believer in the Messiah of Israel, is a faithful witness, and who is extremely knowledgeable with regard to what is happening in Israel today. Next to him is Mr. Fred Hartman. Fred Hartman is the North American director of the Friends of Israel Gospel Ministry. He has gone to Israel on many, many occasions, and he is a noted prophetic speaker in churches throughout the United States. And then to your far left, last but by no means least, is a man who many of us know as Hezi or Ezekiel. And Ezekiel is a believer in the Messiah in recent days, about 8 months, as a matter of fact. He is also a man who has distinguished himself in the Israeli military and is a retired Israeli general who fought in many of the conflicts that we will be discussing and can bring a first-hand and, I believe, objective comment with regard to the events that are transpiring there today. So, without any further introduction, we're going to move right into the questions. Let me begin, and I will sometimes direct the question to one of you. Sometimes it will be just a general question that any of you can jump on, and you can feel free to interact. You need not agree with one another. You can add to somebody else's comments, but again, I will insist that you deal with the question that I'm asking and that you keep your remarks brief. Though I know you can spend great periods of time in response, we want to cover a number of important areas. The first question that I'm going to direct initially to Will Varner, and then any of you can feel free to pick up on that. As we talk about the entire Middle East and what is happening there, is there a biblical basis for the conflict in the Middle East? Is there anything of biblical significance that tells us that these things were going to occur, therefore we ought not to be caught off guard or surprised at what is going on?
The general picture in the prophets of the Old Testament is that towards the end of the age, there will be trouble for Israel. The Jewish scholars refer to it as the birth pangs of the Messiah, the birth pangs that Israel will go through before the Messiah comes. Zechariah, for example, chapters 12 through 14 speak about Jerusalem being the center of international attention and conflict. Both Zechariah 12 and 14 says that in the last days, all the nations of the world will come against Jerusalem. So we do know that according to biblical prophecy, there's going to be a lot of antagonism, there's going to be a lot of conflict that is going to be centering on Israel from the nations of the world. The impression one gets as you read Zechariah is that there is a hatred by the nations of the world. There is an antagonism. There is a desire to destroy Jerusalem and get rid of what they view as the Jewish problem. But yet, Zechariah 12 through 14, if you read on, says that in spite of their antagonism against Israel and their desire to destroy it, that stone will turn on them. I will make Jerusalem a burdensome stone. It also says that when they come against Jerusalem, finally, when things look like there's no hope left for Jerusalem, the Lord will step in, and the Lord will come, and His feet shall stand in that day upon the Mount of Olives, Zechariah 14:5. And the Lord ultimately, at the end times, will deliver Israel. As we move to the New Testament, such a passage as Revelation 16, that all nations shall be gathered to a place that is called in the Hebrew Harmagedo, or as we know it in English, Armageddon. So obviously, both in the Old and New Testament, there is a picture, and I've summed it up obviously, that the nations will be bearing down on Jerusalem and on Israel. Joel 3 says that there will be nations gathered in the valley of Jehoshaphat. Isaiah chapter 63 speaks about the nations gathered close to Edom, where they will be judged. And so there are many, many biblical passages, both old and new, which says that there is a basic antagonism and hatred that the nations have for Israel and Jerusalem. And so the picture that we have is that they will come. So that, yes, there is a biblical basis for a conflict going on in the Middle East.
Thank you. Anybody else want to add to that?
I might just add that the basis for the conflict does not begin with Zechariah, nor does it begin with the book of Revelation. But we can go all the way back to the book of, we can go back to the book of Romans, where the Lord says that Jacob have I loved and Esau have I hated. And we find a breakdown or a breaking away, even when there are twins, two children, same mother, same birth, you might say. And God gives to us a picture from the book of Genesis, picked up in the book of Romans, that there is a difference between the sons of Isaac, Jacob, and Esau. I'll just bring that point out, and I'm sure it will be developed much further.
Okay. And the point being that the Jewish people would come through Jacob and the Arab race from Esau.
That's correct.
And that Esau would be a man of war.
Correct.
Okay. Anybody else want to address that question? If not, let me move on to a second question, and I will open this up to any of you who would like to interact with it. What is the origin of the name Palestine in the Bible, and why is it sometimes used to describe the land that in the Bible is called Israel, Canaan, or the Promised Land? I often hear people speaking of Palestine. I often hear people speaking of Israel. Where did the name Palestine, as it is applied to that geographical location, what is the origin of that?
I'll answer. The first time that we hear about the Philistine is in Exodus, that God does not lead the children of Israel on the road of the Philistine, which later on we hear about this road mentioned as Via Maris, the road, the sea. In the Bible, we find later on the four cities of the Philistine, which is Gath, Gaza, Ekron, and Ashdod in the Roman period, after the destruction of the Second Temple, 70, and later on the Second Revolt, 132 to 135, that land, that part of Judah, was called by the Roman also Palestine, the part of the Roman Empire. And a long time, this name was not mentioned anymore. No land of Palestine or Palestine exists. Only during the British Mandate, when in 19...
I don't want to go that far yet. I'd like to stay with the origin of the term Palestine. Yes, if you want to add.
The origin of the word in Hebrew is Plishtim. If you take the root of the word, it means invaders. In the Bible it says that these people are coming from outside. That's the reason they are sitting right in the seashore. They're not coming inside the land. Right in the seashore. Plishtim, invaders. Most recently I heard that they believe they came from Greece or that area, but they are invaders. The Roman Emperor that chose the name Palestine, it was in order to take any root of Israeli or Jewish name or origins from the land. That's why it chose the name Palestine, in order to humiliate, even to take the name from the land, not only the people.
Anybody else?
As Mr. Langbaum said, and also my colleague here, the Romans were the first ones to give a political designation called Palestine. They called it Palestina in 135 AD. And that was the first time there was an area that was politically designated as Palestine. So the idea that the country of Palestine goes way back into antiquity simply is not historically accurate. There really has never been, apart from the Roman Empire, an independent country called Palestine. It was just designated that by the Romans in 135 AD.
Okay, thank you. Anybody else want to address that question? If not, I want to move on to a third question, and this will be open to any of you who would like to respond to it. You've already alluded to the fact that in 70 AD, the Romans came up against Israel, and they did so again in 135 AD, when they changed the name of Jerusalem to Palestine, and no Jews were allowed to go into the city of Jerusalem. If they did, they would be executed under Roman law. And the Jews were, in 70 AD and 135 AD, scattered throughout the world, particularly the Mediterranean world. Question I want to raise then is, given those historic facts, have Jews always lived in the land of Israel, or were there periods of time when there were no Jews in the land of Israel? And then secondly, in terms of the modern situation, when did Jews begin to return to the land of Israel from the places wherein they had been scattered in 70 and 135 A.D.? Hezzy, we haven't heard from you yet.
My grandfather was born in Israel in 1864. And we know in the family that there was never a time that Jews were not in Israel. From the destruction of the Second Temple till now, there were numbered. I think that I've been told that in 1864 there were about 40,000-50,000 Jews in Israel. So there, maybe there was a time that there were only 10,000 or 15,000, but there was no time that no Jews were in Israel.
Would you like to address, and I know that some of the others would like to as well, but while you're on that, when did the present Aliyah, and you might want to tell them what that means, when did the modern return to Israel begin in earnest?
This started to 1947.
No. Hold on for just a second. He's continuing, and then we'll get to it.
The massive return of Jews to Israel was in the late 80s. We might say that in 1870 it started. And till 1948, there were about 600,000 Jews in Israel. So we can assume that the most of the immigration was after the First World War. But before that, there was an immigration, we know it by names and so on. We say the first one and the second one and the third one and so on.
Thank you.
I would like just to...
Good and loud, Ellie, please. Raise your voice.
I would like just, first of all, not to correct Marvin, but the Jerusalem after the destruction of the Jerusalem was called Ilia Capitolina, no more Jerusalem, in 135. And for some reasons, all my colleagues, including Marv, considering Israel just as the western side of the River Jordan, Jewish people lived in both sides of the River Jordan, and it was always one part. The eastern side of Jordan, this is an artificial country being created by the British after the war.
Okay, we do have questions that will get to that a little later. And
Jewish people lived in the other side as well all the time. Since the destruction of the temple, we have evidence, we have archaeological excavation. The Jewish people lived in both sides of the River Jordan.
Yeah, I don't think any of us disagree with that, Ellie. We all would concur with that. But that really, I'm really after what caused, we have determined, I think, that there has always been a continuity of Jews living in the land of Israel, even after 70 AD and 135 AD. But I would like the audience to have some comprehension of what has caused the influx of Jews starting in the 1870s and the 1880s and where they came from and what started them back there, which I feel is important for the people to understand.
Okay, I'll reply to that. With the end of the Roman conquest and the change of the name to Ilia Capitolina, the conquered city, that's one of the reasons that the Romans had to, firstly, to disperse the Jews across the land of Israel, into the diaspora, as we say, It was by firstly changing the name of the country and then making it a crime for any Jew to return back to his land. The punishment was death if the Jew returned back to his own land. The Romans tried to erase the name of Israel, or even Palestine, which they themselves gave to the Holy Land. And it was purely called Aelia Capitolina, the Temple Mount, when the temple was destroyed and was no more, was rebuilt upon by the Roman temple, the temple to Venus. And the Romans sprayed salt right across the hills of Jerusalem, so that not even trees or any vegetation would grow in Jerusalem after that. They tried to keep the Jews from coming back, but the Jews did come back. They came back after the Roman conquest. They came back under punishment of death. They came to their Wailing Wall, which now became the most important part of the Jewish life, of the Jewish dream. The Wailing Wall, the Western Wall, all that remained of the temple. They would come, some were killed because of their returning back to the Holy Land. And the Jews left, the Jews that were in Jerusalem at one time when they were dispersed, some went into the Galilee to live. And there in the Galilee, the new Jewish settlements began to raise. And Jewish religion was spread from Jerusalem to a place somewhere near Tel Aviv called Yavne. And from there, the Jewish religion and Jewish teaching and Jewish preaching started to spread across the land. I just want to point out that where Jewish settlement was concerned, there was a continuous settlement right through the ages, from Roman to Byzantine to Arab to Crusader to Mameluke to the recent Turkish period. And there were cities in Israel. One of them is Pekin, which they say it has continuous Jewish settlement throughout the ages, even after the temple was destroyed.
Thank you. That was insightful.
The historical circumstances that gave rise to the modern Jewish settlement of Israel, it really is the same historical circumstance which gave rise to the majority of the Jewish population in the United States of America, and that is the Russian pogroms, the Russian persecutions of the large Jewish population under the Tsar in the late 19th century. And there were many who said, this is enough, we want to leave this, and so they left. A lot of them came west, settling in England and then finally in the United States of America. Between 1881 and 1917, 3 million Jewish people from Russia came to the United States of America. But the same thing that prompted them to come west to America also prompted a number of young Jewish intellectual pioneers to settle in what was then called Turkish Palestine. And they came there, often subsidized by outside wealthy British Jewish people, and they began to drain the swamps, they began to work the land, they began to die of malaria, they began to be attacked by some of the local Arabs, but they continued going. And after the severe pogroms in 1903, 1906, in Russia, another large wave of Russian Jewish pioneers came. Among those were people like David Ben-Gurion, who later became one of the founders of the State of Israel. Then after the First World War, an even larger wave of immigration came, primarily from Poland and also from Russia, so that by 1947, 650,000 Jewish people were living in the land of Israel. And of course, the Second World War with the Holocaust was the final historical circumstance which prompted large-scale immigration of Jews. But during the British Mandate, sadly, in the 1920s and 30s, the doors of immigration were oftentimes locked to Jews wanting to flee from Hitler's Germany. But those are some of the historical circumstances. But I often say that the same historical circumstance which began the modern Jewish settlement in Israel is that which gave rise to the majority of Jewish people here in America. And if you ask a Jewish person here in America, where did your father come from or your grandfather come from, 95% of the time they'll say, well, they came from Russia.
Okay. I would like just to complete the answer of Will. 1817, repeating, 870, a French Jew called Karl Netter came to visit the Holy Land. He saw swamps, desert, and this man decided that the future of this country is agriculture. He bought some land and he established the first agriculture school, and the name was Mikveh Yisrael. And these students, they studied in this, by the way, Jews and Arabs as well. The Arabs did not, they refused, because they were not farmers, they were Bedouin. The whole country was just Bedouin. And the first two settlements, modern settlements, were established by the Baron of Rothschild from Paris, 1882. Two agricultural settlements. Then 1870 and 1882, both of these people, without getting in touch, they decided the future for the modern state of Israel will be farming and coming back to Tobit.
It's important to note that these lands were bought, were purchased legally. They were not expropriated. They were not stolen from anyone. But the modern Jewish settlement of Israel is done on purchased land, not expropriated land.
I'd like to just go back for one moment to something that was said before concerning the nation of Israel, whether there were Jews that always lived in the land. One of the problems is Jewish people were often not allowed to live in Jerusalem, though they lived in the land. And some mistake the fact that they could not live in Jerusalem, that there were no Jews in the land. Also, moving up to something more modern, I think we cannot leave out the name of Theodor Herzl.
That's the next question.
Okay.
May the audience make the assumption that all of you would concur that there was a continuity of Jewish people, however small at different times of history, always living in the land, and number two, the great return of Jews from all over the world begins somewhere around 1870 or 1880 in different cycles. Is that correct for them to assume that? Okay, the next question I would like to raise, which has already been anticipated in kind of a chronological sequence that we're trying to develop for you, is George Washington is the father of America. Theodor Herzl would be viewed by the Jewish people as the modern father of the land of Israel. Briefly now, would you comment on Theodor Herzl, what he was like, what his vision was, and what he achieved? And let's just stick to Theodor Herzl and that area.
Sure. Theodor Herzl was a reporter from Austria, and he covered the trial of Captain Dreyfus. And even though Dreyfus, this was in France, by the way, even though Dreyfus, the evidence against him was not that strong, he was sentenced to Devil's Island. And seeing these things, in fact, it happened twice, seeing these things, Herzl felt that as Svi said, that there was total antagonism against the Jewish people. And he called together a Congress, I believe it was 1897, and in that, he wrote a paper, and in the paper declared that as a result of the meeting that he had founded a modern state of Israel within 5 or 50 years. And if you count your years from 1897, there was a UN resolution regarding the nation of Israel that I'm sure will come up in 1947, just 50 years later. So he was really the father of modern Israel.
Someone else?
It just goes to prove, I mean, we're talking about Herzl, that it was Herzl came at the right time when anti-Semitism started, you know, began in France, that case of Captain Dreyfus. I mean, if it wasn't Herzl, it would have been somebody else. But the point is, the principle is that the Jewish people need a land of their own, a nation of their own, in their own land, where once there will not be, and there will never be anti-Semitism again when the Jewish nation come to their own land. So Herzl was actually following in the footsteps of what the prophecies had said for the Jewish people. That from that time, the talk of the Jewish home in the land of Israel, not in Uganda, as Herzl was promised. A bigger and much better and more fertile place than our country. But in the land of Israel, the Jewish nation, to be built up once again, where there will not be anti-Semitism with the coming of the return of the Jews to their own land.
If I could add just one sentence to what Alan said, it only proves the sovereignty of God once again.
Yes.
It's maybe important also to know when Herzl came with a program to return to the homeland, the majority of the Jewish leaders rejected him. They said, this man is dangerous. He's a mental case. Where does he want to bring the Jews? To swampy land? To desert? To malaria? He could not prove anything. He had just one answer. If you will, it's not a dream, and we will.
Anyone else want to address that?
Even though Herzl was not a what you would call a religious Jew at the beginning of this, he did not do it primarily for religious reasons. He did it for anti-Semitic reasons, but he was almost forced to do that because he had always believed, well, the answer to anti-Semitism is for the Jew to assimilate, to be accepted in European society, to be cultured, to be educated, and he was. But then that all became shattered and came crumbling down when he saw in France, the first country in Europe to give freedom and citizenship to the Jewish people, in modern cultured France, he saw this vicious anti-Semitism and people crying in the streets, death to the Jew, death to the Jew, and it completely shattered his whole idea that if we just assimilate and if we just be like the nations, then they'll stop hating us. And he had a complete change in his thinking and went back and wrote the paper, as my friend said there, Judenstaat, the Jewish state, and said the only answer to anti-Semitism is for us to have our own country. And they said, he's Meshuggah, he's crazy. But time has shown that he was right in his estimation.
And an interesting thing, just a PS to the panel's comments, is that, as has already been mentioned, a great majority of Jewish leaders were against Theodor Herzl because they thought he would start another round of anti-Semitism through the world by calling for a Jewish homeland. And so most of the Jews did not support him. And the interesting thing is that his closest advisor was a Bible-believing Christian, and a lot of great prophetic preachers at the turn of the century were supportive of Theodor Herzl, and Moody Bible Institute went on record of supporting a Jewish homeland and was supportive of Theodor Herzl. And one day a book ought to be written on the Bible-believing support of Theodor Herzl, the modern father of Israel, and how they, in a very significant way, participated in the emergence of the modern state of Israel. Well, to change gears, distinguished panel, you know and I know that history said that the sun never set on the British Empire. And we all realize that the British Empire was for a period of time one of the great world powers. But what is not, interestingly enough, very widely known in America is that Great Britain played, for good or for bad, a very strategic part in the emergence of the modern state of Israel, and in fact controlled that part of the world roughly from the First World War to after the Second World War. And I would like some of the distinguished panel to address, so that our audience has something of an understanding of the implications, Great Britain's part in the emergence of the modern state of Israel and what occurred.
England had a very great interest in Suez Canal. They had to defend Suez Canal. So they were in Egypt. The Ottoman Empire started from Egypt till Turkey, what's known to Minor Asia. The life of the Jews was very difficult among the Turks, because they were Muslims, and they were primitive. They didn't care about no roads, nothing. They didn't do nothing for the states of for the land of Palestine, then called. Now, in 1917, General Allenby was assigned to conquer Israel, and he did it. And from that time, England got demanded on Israel, and France got demanded on Syria. And all the division of Israel and Syria in the north is from that time by the, it wasn't called the United Nations, but the
League of Nations.
League of Nations. I know it in Hebrew, I don't know the preparation in the...
Okay.
I think the whole story began in 1917 when the British conquered the land of Palestine from the Turks. And a part of Jordan and Transjordan was under British power, Egypt was under British power, and Syria was under the French regime. And this was a plague, and it was purely the big powers at that time, England on one side and France on the other side. They both played their cards well. They pitted these countries against one another. They caused the Arabs to attack the Jews. They caused the hatred against the Jews. And oil. Oil, even at that time, was the main part of that struggle. When the British needed the oil in Transjordan or in Egypt, and they divided the land amongst these small little Arab countries, and the same thing the French did with the Syrians. And in the end, when the British and the French left these countries, The people of those countries rose up and started fighting one another for the conquest of those places.
The Balfour Declaration states this: His Majesty's government views with favor the establishment in Palestine of a homeland for the Jewish people, it being understood that none of the rights of the inhabitants or the rights of any Jews worldwide will be infringed on in this decision. That is the wording of the Balfour Declaration. But it did commit, for the first time, a world power is committed to establishing a homeland for the Jewish people. That was the significance of the Balfour Declaration. Unfortunately, as I'm sure we're going to get into, the country backed down on that commitment and did not follow through.
Thank you. I want to simply add to the comments that have been made, because I want you to understand that that area of the world, all the way down to Egypt, was controlled by the Ottoman Turkish Empire for 400 years, from 1517 to 1917, Turkey. So there was no Palestinian state. There was even no Lebanese state to speak of. They came into existence prior to the First World War, and in part, many of you are familiar with Lawrence of Arabia. Lawrence of Arabia was a British officer. Lawrence of Arabia fought with the British against the Ottoman Turkish Empire, which was allied with Germany during the First World War. And so in the First World War, Great Britain controlled, captured from Turkey, that part of the world. And actually, because some of the Arab nations or some of the Arab peoples fought with Lawrence of Arabia, with the British, against the Ottoman Turkish Empire or Germany at that time, they carved out a large part of what was then called Palestine and established the land of Lebanon. It is a relatively modern nation. And from 1917 to 1947, Great Britain controlled Palestine, and there was never a Palestinian state there. Any other comments before I move on? How would you, and I'm trying to move up progressively, how would you define a Palestinian? And were Jews called Palestinians before 1948? Yes, Menno?
An Israeli will not call himself Palestinian because he don't recognize this name. He will call himself, I'm an Israeli, a Jewish Israeli. Because for an Israeli, Israel never ever lose the name Israel. It was from the beginning Israel. For an Arab, as an Arab, if he was born in the land of Israel before 1947, 1948, or after 1948, he is called a Palestinian. Like as a Jew, he's calling an Israeli. Whenever you say the word Palestinian, just consider it an Israel. An Arab will say Palestine, and Israeli will say Israeli.
Okay, you're anxious to get into that. Go ahead.
I'm sorry.
Good and loud, though. They got to hear you.
I think that you are wrong. Never were Palestinian until 1967, ladies and gentlemen. There were Arabs in Palestine like there were Jews in Palestine. 1948, in the War of Liberation, the Jordanian managed to capture a part of Palestine, a part of the British Mandate, the Jordanian with the help of the British. The Egyptian managed to conquer the part of Palestine which was called the Gaza Strip. The Jordanian annexed that part that they conquered and they called it West Bank of Jordan. They never called the people that lived there Palestinian. Never. After 1967, when Israel liberated the West Bank, they started to call the people in the western side of the River Jordan, these people that never had full right, they started to call the Palestinian. I'm repeating, before 1967, we did not know the name of Palestinian. Were citizens, Jordanian citizens, in the western side of the River Jordan, which was called the West Bank by the Jordanian. Was never recognized by any other countries except Great Britain and Pakistan.
I think you're both right, because my colleague was saying the term Palestinian today, he was defining it, the term Palestinian today, and you were defining it as it was before 1967. You're both right.
You should understand that that was a teacher with his pupil. Okay, anybody else want to touch on the concept of Palestinian? Yes, Hezi.
Palestinians, the name, they called themselves Palestinians in the late 18th century. And I know at least 20 years before the State of Israel, two zealot Arab groups who called themselves Palestinian and another name.
So, excuse me, can you all hear him in the back? So try to keep your voice up if you can, please.
So we can say that the Palestinian problem, that we'll see it later, is the most dangerous problem that Israel is facing, because they are the detonator here in the Middle East. I don't want to go into it now. But that what happened to Israel or to the Jews in Palestine before the State of Israel was from zealot Palestinians, and they called themselves Palestinians, because the most dangerous man was Haj Amin al-Husseini. He was the leader and the religious leader. Haj is like a bishop, something in the Muslim religion, and he went to Germany, and he was watching the final solution of the Jewish people there. So he was witness to those 6 million who were exterminated in Europe. So he called himself Palestinian. So we can see it later in other names. We can see it in the Gaza Strip before 1967, those Palestinians there, and they were very zealous. So the problem arised in the late 800, I think, and 1870, 18. But it started very strongly after 1921. Okay. And many of my family were slaughtered in Hebron in 1929, also by a group called themselves Palestinians. The Holy War for the liberate Palestine from Jews.
But would this distinguished panel agree that there was never a Palestinian state, there was no entity that was called a Palestinian state, and that was started after 1967 for propaganda purposes in the West? Is that something you would all concur with?
Right. Let me just get down to the fact that till 1948, there were no Palestinians. There were Jordanians that at that time were ruled over by King Abdullah and the British that ruled over Palestine at that time. And when the British divided, or they say partitioned, that country
One part was given over to Jordan, which was originally Transjordan, and the other part became the land of Israel. And so there was no Palestinian problem at that time. And wherever the Palestinians came into, most of them were given over into Jordan. There was that land of, which they claimed was in Jordan territory. And it was only after 1967, after the Six-Day War, that we hear that the Palestinian problem arises. Jordan does not want the Palestinians. Jordan is not a Palestinian country. The king of Jordan, who is today, is Hussein. He is not a Palestinian himself. He is a Hashmonite, and a Hashmonite is a Bedouin, a wanderer. Hussein doesn't want the Palestinians because they caused enough trouble when they were there in his country, and he had to throw them out. So there is no Palestinian question or Palestinian problem or even a Palestinian today.
Then that was established, I want to reiterate again, historically and factually, after 1967, so that
for
the Western press could say to the world, look at what the Jews have done to this poor Palestinian state.
Where did the camps from? Where did they come from? The refugee camps. The Jordanians placed the Palestinians in refugee camps, did not allow them to live in their own country, amongst their own people, of the Jordanians, but kept them aside, separated from the Jordanians, and called them refugees.
Okay, we'll pick up on that in just a few moments.
Complete that answer of Alan. West Bank, which is called today Palestinian, they had members in the Jordanian parliament, members and as well ministers. They were never called as ministers from Palestine. They were called as ministers, by the way, if I'm talking about the minister, what you call secretary, they were members of the parliament, of the Jordanian parliament, from the western side of Jordan. Never was called this member, he's a Palestinian, and this minister, he's a Palestinian. A member of the Jordanian government from the West Bank of the Hashemite Kingdom of Jordan.
Do you understand what he's saying? He is saying that Arabs who lived in what we call, and my next question is going to deal with the West Bank, but Arabs who lived in the West Bank were not part of a Palestinian state or government. They were involved in the Jordanian government, okay? So that, in theory, loosely, however it may have been, the West Bank people were part of Jordan prior to 1967. Yes?
When I referred, I referred to Palestinian groups. The Palestinian state, as they say it, the Arabs, started in 1947 when the nation, the United Nations, divided Israel. So there was no name Israel. Israel wasn't established. The name was Palestine. So they said this will be to the Jews and this will be to the Arabs. But the name state, Palestine or something like that, never appeared. We didn't know it. It started only from the, not the Palestinians, but the pressure of the Arab states to create a problem here. And they succeeded, because we see it in the media now, in the United States. I saw a picture of Arabs, and in the rear it was said the West Bank, like it's, you know, it's another state, the West Bank. Maybe they'll find another one.
Okay, let me move right on and say, from 1948 to 1967, from 1917 to 1947, we said earlier that Great Britain had captured that area called Palestine popularly from the Ottoman Turkish Empire, so Great Britain controlled it from 1917 to 1947. In 1947, following the Second World War, Great Britain had more than 100,000 troops stationed in Palestine, trying to keep now an uneasy peace between the Arabs who lived there and the Jews who lived there. And Great Britain clearly favored the Arab population for political reasons, and eventually Great Britain had passed in 1938 what was called the White Papers. That restricted Jewish emigration into Israel to 15,000 a year in 1938. Why? I want you to have an understanding. Because Adolf Hitler was moving through Europe. Jews were trying to flee Adolf Hitler and the Nazi war machine. They were not allowed to come to America because of immigration quotas. They were not allowed to go to Canada. They were not allowed to go to Australia. They were not allowed to go to most of the countries of the world. They were fleeing from Germany at first to other countries in Europe, and the Nazis followed right behind with their war machine. So many of them were now trying to get into Israel. And the surrounding Arab nations did not like, most of them did not like the Jews coming back to Israel. So they put pressure on Great Britain, which controlled that area of the world, to restrict Jewish immigration at a time when Jews were fleeing for their very lives and were not allowed to get into most of the nations of the world. When former Prime Minister Menachem Begin came to office as the Prime Minister of Israel, he was called a terrorist. But historically, that is because he was trying to get Jews who were fleeing Adolf Hitler and had no place in the world to go. He was trying to smuggle them into Israel, and Great Britain was trying to stop it. The reason they were trying to stop it, understand the historical backdrop, is in the First World War, the Arabs of that area fought with the British against Germany. Now they have a Second World War, and they want the Arabs to fight with them once again. So the Arabs said to Britain, you are to stop allowing the Jews to come in. And so they restricted immigration to 15,000, and Great Britain, Menachem Begin fought against the British trying to smuggle in Jews, as did many others, so he was called a terrorist. During the Second World War, the Jews fought with the Allies against the Nazis. At the end of the Second World War, more Jews began, now survivors of the Holocaust, had no place to go, started to come across the Mediterranean into Israel, as did Zvi. Great Britain still had in force her white papers, which restricted Jewish emigration. So they would trap the ships with their sophisticated ships, radar planes, these ships bringing Jewish refugees. They would put them on Cyprus in the Mediterranean Sea, intern them there for about a year, and allow 15,000 a year to come in from these, as it were, concentration camps. There then came a ship called the Exodus. You're familiar, most of you, with the Exodus. The problem just got too big and out of control with 100,000 troops in Israel. Great Britain could not resolve the problem between the Arabs and the Jews. And so in 1947, Great Britain turned the matter over to the United Nations, the forerunner of the League of Nations. In 1917, Great Britain had captured that part of the world. In 1922, the League of Nations, world body, gave a mandate to Great Britain to establish a homeland for the Jew in Palestine. And as has already been mentioned, Great Britain came out with the Balfour Declaration calling for a homeland for the Jew in Palestine. All of these years now passed from 1917 to 1947, and they did not do it because of political reasons. Now they had 100,000 troops. It was bankrupting Great Britain, and they turned the matter over to the United Nations in 1947. The United Nations voted to partition Palestine, to give part of it, the larger part and the better part, to the Arabs for a state, and a smaller part to Israel for a state, even though Great Britain had promised Israel much more under the mandate, did not do it, turned it over to the United Nations. The United Nations voted to partition, to make a Jewish state and an Arab state. On May 14, 1948, over 6 months, Great Britain withdrew, favoring the Arab populations, giving the Arabs the better positions, raiding Jewish settlements and confiscating any kind of military equipment they might have. On May 14, 1948, Ben-Gurion, first Prime Minister of Israel, declared Israel a nation among the nations of the world. And the next day, the surrounding Arab nations attacked. Now, having brought you up to that point, I would like some of our distinguished panelists to say a little bit about the War of Independence. That's the War of 1948. Zvi, you fought in the War of Independence. Now, hold a second before you get anxious.
Yes.
Wait a minute. Hold it. You crossed the Mediterranean Sea. You were taken to the island of Cyprus, as I had mentioned, by the British. You eventually came to Israel. You got off of the ship. You were taken into the Israeli military. You were trained very quickly how to plant mines and to disarm minefields. You fought in 48. Just tell us a little bit, very quickly, because I want to go to some of the other men, about what it was like for you in 1948, just coming through the Holocaust.
Yes, when we come from Europe, it was not like now they are coming with the nice ships. We come with the fishing boats. And we receive many promises. We will come to Israel, we will fight, we will receive everything. That I mean, a nice promise. But we come, and I know that after the declaration of the State of Israel in 1949, it was declared by the United Nations. A state, of course, I remember in 14th of May, when Ben-Gurion declared the State of Israel in Israel, so to start the war. I was this time in the army. They took me to the landmines explosive. I never known to shoot, but in 2-3 days I was a soldier like 10 years. But never mind, we have to fight. But what says, as said Chizak, Haja Emir al-Husseini, he was the big mufti of Jerusalem. He says in this time, what was written with ink, it will be erased with blood. And we have to...
Well, he was talking about the United Nations resolution to partition Palestine into two states.
Yeah.
And you're saying what he said was, what was written with ink will be erased with blood.
And so he said, and until now, we don't erase with blood, they erase with their blood. And we have to fight for our independence. And we saw by the Arabs, how many they are. They attacked us for about 8 countries from all sides, in west, east, either north, from any side they attacked us, and they were sure that this is the last problem with the Jewish. There will not more Jewish problem, as Hitler said. But they make a big mistake, and the Lord help us, and we were fighting, and we have the State of Israel, not according to the United Nations 47, but a big country as has to be.
Thank you. Hezi, you are a retired general. You fought in 48, 56, 67. Would you address some of the implications of 1948, Israel's preparedness, and some of the things that occurred in 48?
I would like to speak only about the war of 1947. The war started, the war itself, in 29th of November. The night they declared, the nation declared in 29th of November 1947 about a Jewish state, and it was a very big celebration in Israel. Till now I remember myself dancing in Jerusalem, the streets, till dawn. It was from all the night we were dancing and singing, and it was, we were very happy the first time we've got a state of ourselves. But we didn't realize what's coming, and the next day we realized when they started to shoot at buses. We couldn't traffic from Jerusalem to Tel Aviv. It's about 40 miles, something like that. We had to pass about 3 Arab cities, Ramle, Lud, and in the middle, Latrun, and so on. And they were fighting, shooting, and we couldn't travel from place to place. And we saw that this is not a game. This is a war. I was a company commander in the war that started after 15th of May 1948, when the British left Israel. So this is the war against the Arab countries, but the war started in November against groups. And some famous groups from Iraq, from Jordan, from Egypt, many places they came from. But what I wanted to tell you is about the preparation. It's interesting to see how the hand of the Lord was in Israel at that time, as it was all the time. Because there is no such a thing that so few people could resist all the Arab countries. You won't find any example in the world like this. And it can be only the hand of the Lord. Because I think that I was one of 2 battalions, that's all. We had 2 battalions It was the battalion. It was companies with platoons. Every platoon was so important that we knew that who was the commander of that platoon. A commander of a section was like a general in the United States Army, something like that. We had for 10 men, 2 rifles, and 2 grenades or something like that. You know, when I think about it now as a modern army, and I think how we fought at those times, it's something like from fantasy land. You can't imagine that. The Arabs had everything, and especially 1948. I saw miracles, I wasn't saved them. But I believed always in God. I believed, I know that what I believed then wasn't what I should have believed. But I knew there is God. And what happened there, I saw only the end of God. I remember once a whole Egyptian battalion attacking 32 men. And suddenly, I don't know why, they retreated and turned around all the men and retreated. Like the attack, they retreated. So when the back were to the Israelis, they killed them. There were many miracles.